Come one, come all, and gather round, we'll tell our tales to thee. Of saints and whores and demon cores, of sights for all to see. Come ye all around the fire, and listen all the while to tales of holes and mystery we call the Theophiles. We call the Theophiles.
Just start calling. Theo? Oh, God. Thank God that wasn't recorded.
Oh.
Pretty racist.
Yeah. Hello, and welcome to Bunta Vista. Welcome to episode XIV of the Theophiles, whatever that means.
We might have got that right.
We might have got that right. I checked.
Famously, we've got it wrong nearly every other time that we've ever
done. Every other time.
Yeah. Yep.
But nothing in this episode will be wrong.
Yes.
Or questionable, which is good. I'm Theo, and you can see me, but I can't see you. I'm sitting comfortably upon this standard issue couch within a 5 meter by 5 meter room that would be entirely nondescript, except for its lack of ceiling for observability. Otherwise, this room, which we may refer to as Universe 36, contains a 42-inch Sony Bravia hooked up to a PlayStation 4 with access to Plex, a laptop, and a fridge that's stocked from the reverse side with cans of mid-strength beer and ready-made serves of bolognese, which we heat up with the microwave that sits atop the fridge. A tasteful curtain can be pulled back across the tiled section of the room that can be used for wet activities like toileting and showering. It's day 56 of the experiment. The only signs of stress in our relationship, which are eagerly noted and tracked by our observers, is largely sidestepped by a truce that has been formed. I cannot promise not to fart while drinking a can of Captain Sensible and playing the Resident Evil 4 remake on professional difficulty, but I can promise to lean away from Ben. Now, also with me, drinking an expertly brewed IPA and looking at something cool on his laptop that he's about to show me out of genuine mutual curiosity, it's my good friend Ben. How you going, man?
Hey, T-Bird. Captain Sensible, that's the Bolter mid-strength?
That's the Bolter mid-strength.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting choice. Just because, you see, the IPA that I've got here, it's from an independent brewery. It's got the Independent Brewers Association little icon there. So it's like an easy way you can tell whether it's owned by one of the big sort of corporate fat cats or, you know, whether you're supporting. I mean, I guess if it's a nice tasting beer, and I know the price can be a bit of a factor, you know, that's pretty good.
Sort of mid-strength, so I don't get too drunk. What's this one? Four Pines. There's no way that's being responsibly...
No, Four Pines
part of Asahi Beverages.
Yeah, they got bought out quite a while ago, Four Pines. It used to be great, though. But hey, what can you do? You know, that's...
What can you do? What are you drinking, Ben? What's in your hand?
Oh, I'm drinking...
what are you pumping?
The Welder's Dog Darkwood IPA, which is from two four-packs that I... Let's not say that Chev and I won doing trivia at the Welder's Dog in Inverell, New South Wales.
Oh.
We swooped in from out of town.
What a treat.
And we demolished the people of Inverell at a sold-out trivia night by an unbelievable margin.
And were they other two-person teams? Well, this is like 10-person teams, right?
Yeah. There were a few two-person teams, but it was mostly large groups. But
who's carrying the team there, you or Chev?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of pop culture stuff in there. And, I mean, Chev is an off-screen character for the listener of this podcast. He's just a man that I work with who's a very he's a unique specimen. He doesn't really engage with popular culture in any way, shape, or form. He's mostly been off the internet for his entire life, doesn't really watch TV or movies.
What a way to be.
Oh, he has a really great life. He's like one of the happiest people I know by a considerable margin.
It's funny how that correlates, eh?
It's weird.
It's so weird how that
You ask him like what he's doing on his days off, and it's either reading, it's awesome, or he's like, I'm going to build a contraption. Like, fuck. That sounds so good.
This is why I don't want to work anymore. I want to build contraptions. I've got shit on my desk here to build a contraption. I'm going to do it.
Maybe. Honestly, it seems almost unfair that he was born in a time where just being like a tinkerer doesn't really exist.
Yeah, like you can't be like sponsored by a patron.
Yes.
To work in their dungeons.
There's no local marquee to like fund him just building shit. Like, weirdly enough, the bar is probably the best chance he'll ever have in his life of being paid to just build devices.
Yeah.
Where we're like, hey, we want something stupid that does this. And he just disappears for a couple of weeks and he presents a capital O object. And you're like, wow. All right, you did it. Thanks, man.
Oh, what a beautiful time.
Yeah, and that's been 2 to 3 minutes about my friend Chev.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this may be universe 36 or whatever that was.
Yep. We didn't spend a lot of time on that. I'm sorry. I got distracted thinking about how much I appreciate and idolize Patrick Shevlin. So we're in an ideal sort of a micro, ideal for us, I guess, an ideal sort of micro universe where we're free of responsibility.
Yes.
Fully loaded Plex. Who's in charge of the Plex?
I think we just send a message to Andrew if we want stuff loaded on there.
Yeah. Can you get me this?
Yeah.
But I want the this cut.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks very much. Yeah.
With the subtitles, but the ones that are burnt into the movie because they've got like cool action, like comic book kind of.
I hate that shit so much. The John Wick 1 subtitles for the Russian parts. That's like the one very bad stupid thing in the whole series. It looks like absolute dog shit. Why it's did you good do that?
Yeah. But we journey now to a less ideal universe. Universe 25.
Is that and ours?
As presented in the procedural Royal Society of Medicine process. Fuck, this was in my annotations and it was like one of three things I wrote down. So apologies.
Proceedings
of the Royal Society of Medicine. Mm. Volume 66, January 1973. Title.
Oh, do you say January 1973?
January 1973.
That's very interesting. That's very, very interesting.
Okay. Title. Death Squared. The Explosive Growth and Demise of a Mouse Population. By John B. Calhoun, MD. We'll probably get emails about how this guy was like evil or not evil or a Malthusian or not a Malthusian. But he's a biologist, so what do you want from me?
Yeah.
They're all nuts.
Yes.
Okay? You don't become a research biologist by having morals and good views on... I think at some point you have to draw some conclusions from your studies.
You don't have to be crazy to work in research biology.
Yeah.
But you do.
But you do, especially if you want to lead it. And it begins as such. I shall largely speak of mice, but my thoughts are on man, on healing, on life and its evolution.
Extraordinary.
It's one of the most extraordinary journal articles I've ever seen. And sorry, just to backtrack a moment, this was presented to me as many of my prior ones have been by listener Amara, who drip feeds me just the most bizarre stuff you could imagine. So thank you again to Amara. Threatening life and evolution are the two deaths, deaths of the spirit and death of the body. Evolution, in terms of ancient wisdom, is the acquisition of access to the tree of life. This takes us back to the white first horse of the apocalypse, which, with its rider, set out to conquer the forces that threaten the spirit with death. Further in Revelation 2.7, we note, "To him who conquers, I will grant to eat the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God." And further on Revelations XXII.2, the leaves of the tree were for the healing of nations. This takes us to the fourth horse of the apocalypse, Revelations VI.7. I saw a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, and with famine, and with pestilence, and by wild beasts of the earth, in brackets, italics mine, by which I mean italics his.
Can we? We've covered so much already.
Yeah. Sure.
All of these biblical allusions are very, very powerful. What's the line that he said? Evolution is being granted access to the tree of life?
Yes. It's the acquisition of access to the tree of life. This guy's spitting some straight fire and we're
on I guess it is. All right. That's beautiful. What a beautiful phrase.
Yeah, and this is the Proceedings of the Royal Society of Medicine.
Yeah.
From the Laboratory of Brain Evolution and Behavior.
More like the Proceedings of the Royal Society of Medicinal Weed, am I right? This guy was smoking on something.
Probably.
Weed.
If you've seen photos of him. This second death has gradually become the predominant concern of modern medicine. And yet there is nothing in the earlier history of medicine or in the precepts embodied by the Hippocratic Oath that precludes medicine from being equally concerned with healing the spirit and healing nations as with healing the body.
I guess nothing explicit. It's just sort of taken as assumed.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Perhaps we might do well to reflect upon another of John's transcriptions in Revelations II:11. He who conquers shall not be hurt by the second death. Subtitle, Bodily Mortality. Let us first consider the second death in Table 1, and I will read from Table 1 now. As in Revelation VI.8, the second death number 1 is sword, the second death number 2 is famine, second death number 3 is pestilence, the second death number 4 is wild beasts. translated handily into ecological expression. Number one was sword, becomes emigration. Number two, which is famine, becomes 2A, resource shortage. 2B, inclement weather and fire and cataclysms of nature. Item three, which was pestilence, is obviously disease. And item four, wild beasts, translates to predation.
Is he extrapolating this from the four horses of the apocalypse?
I believe so, yeah.
Which are famine, pestilence,
war.
Death and war?
Death and war, yeah.
Which one is wild beasts of those
Must
four?
Must be death.
Death is wild beasts?
Must be.
Huh.
The four mortality factors listed in Revelations have direct counterparts with a division of one of them to form a total of five in the ecology of animals in nature, which we've just discussed. I shall briefly treat each of these five mortality factors, then discuss the steps taken to eliminate or drastically reduce the impact of which of each in a utopian environment constructed for mice. Number one.
This is some real, what's he building in there?
Oh, man. What is he building in there? We will discuss. Number one, emigration. Animals in the wild rarely die from the sword directly. Fewer are the deaths from intraspecific combat. So we're talking about species predating themselves.
On each other. Intraspecific as in within the same species. Mm-hmm. That's actually exactly. Quite a nice word.
Yeah.
Intraspecific.
Rather, it is that individuals who have failed in the more symbolic conflicts involved in gaining the right to remain in the locality of their birth or in more preferred habitats take recourse to movement into peripheral, unoccupied, or suboptimal habitats. In strange and less favorable habitats, the emigres become more exposed to other mortality factors. Any removal of excess members from an established population from the point of view of change in its numbers represents mortality. In this sense, emigration is a mortality factor.
And I don't want to do this to you every couple of sentences. Uh-huh. I just want to know that I understand what you're saying that he's saying. So he's talking about clashes within like a group of animals that lead some of those animals to leave their habitat.
To outcast themselves or be outcast, and that counts as mortality as far as the main population is considered.
Yeah, because it's reducing the number, but also something about them being put into probably less ideal circumstances because they're going, yeah.
And it sounds like this guy is on some shit, but all of this is dealt with directly. I cannot emphasize this enough.
Right. Emigre is such a beautiful word to talk about, like, an animal losing a dominance fight and then leaving.
Yeah,
is it emigre?
And being cast down to the lower net that's, like, strung between the hamster cage and whatever. To a resource shortage. Classically, food and water have received the focus of attention with respect to their reduction increasing the likelihood of death. Shortages of shelter, other environmental resources and associates lead to debilitation and an unsatisfactoriness of habitat that culminate in death or failure to reproduce. Species death. 2B, inclement weather. Every species has developed a genetic adaptation to some particular range of external conditions which affect its physiology. Beyond the usual contributions to mortality, flood and fire represent cataclysmic changes that have widespread and more long-lasting effects on population numbers. Number 3, disease. Even though some animals develop some capacity to tolerate the parasites, bacteria that they'd be expected to see, abnormally high densities enhance the likelihood of spread of disease to epidemic proportions. And number 4, predation. And practically every species has, through evolution, had associated with it predators capable of killing some of its members. Despite loss of members from these 5 kinds of mortalities, most species persist over long periods, even those measured in geological time. To do so, every such species has developed capabilities for reproduction requisite to compensate for losses from the normal impact of mortality factors other than aging.
So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
He's describing developing the ability to reproduce because you might die at some point, so obviously your numbers will reduce.
Yeah, and finding, like, caves to live in and finding the, you know, the slice of conditions that your species can survive and thrive within.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically this can go on forever, except for exceptions, which is another thing to note when as we head into the implementation stage of whatever this is.
So we're just in the design phase.
We're just
currently?
In the we're in
or
the
prior art,
the prior art section. That's right. I have omitted senescence, which is old age, as a mortality factor, since it's rare for the animal who lives long enough in nature to reach a post-reproductive age without having succumbed to one of the above mortality factors.
Can I say it? And stop me if this is controversial. Mm. Senescence, one of the top 5 English words.
Absolutely. Love it. Have to Google it every time.
Incredible word. I really like its use when it's describing the phase of life that, I don't know if it's squids or octopuses or all of those things, whatever class of creature that is, cephalopods, but they, after they have sex, they enter senescence, and then that immediately starts a series of events that causes them to die quite soon afterwards.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Senescence. Really good word.
Yeah. Kicks off this. What was the one? I saw an animal that would do the same when it would go into heat, but it would do like a 2-week fuck fest after which, like it's, or during which its bodies, they're all like, all their bodies would just fall apart, like much, much faster than like natural condition or stress from having sex or what have you goes. I wish I could remember what animal that was. If you know the fatal fuck fest animal, please let me know.
Yeah, let us know and then we'll put it in post.
Yeah. Subheading, a mortality-inhibiting environment for mice. Some of the attributes of this environment have been discussed or figured elsewhere. Calhoun, 1969, 1971. Wigotsky, 1970.
Is his first citation himself?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. Because he's referring to an environment that he has built in previous works.
Okay.
So he's going to describe some of the some of the attributes of this, but I will tell you more about what it is that he's built that he doesn't quite capture the flavor of. Item one, which refers to Pale Rider number one, I guess, emigration prevention. A closed physical universe was formed by four 1.3-meter high walls forming a square 2.5 meters to a side. So 2.5 meters by 2.5 meters, 1.5 meters tall.
Yeah. So he's preventing the emigration of mice.
Yeah.
With walls.
With walls, basically. Yes. And this is one of his other affectations. He calls these universes because that's all the mice know. They can't, they're born in here and they exist in these universes and they die in here. This is, as I mentioned earlier, this is universe number 25.
I mean, they would still hear stuff from the outer world.
Yeah, it's sort of in a room in a lab though as well, so
and there'd be
or
an
in a
energy
shed somewhere
kind of exchange between the two.
Although the walls were structured for use by mice to increase the effective use area of the universe, the mice could not climb over the upper 43 centimeter unstructured portion of galvanized metal walls, right? So it's like a possum kind of the metal stuff that wraps the power poles the possums can't climb, right? They've just got galvanized steel at the top. Resource supra availability. Each 64 centimeter linear segment of wall was identically structured. So there's a they're in these 64 centimeter panels. They've got four 7.6 centimeter diameter tunnels, 86 centimeters long, of mesh wire, were soldered vertically to the walls. So the rats can climb up through these tunnels. You've got four of them to a panel. The open lower end, just above the floor, which is covered with ground corn cob, gave access to each tunnel. At 20 centimeter intervals above the floor in each tunnel, there are 20 by 13 by 10 centimeter retreat nesting boxes, right? So they're little apartments for the mice. They climb up the up the mesh tunnel, and they pop out to their little apartment.
Mm-hmm.
15 mice could comfortably rest in a single nest box. Thus, there were four-unit walk-up, one-room apartments in each cell. A wire mesh food hopper with a 15 by 25 centimeter surface was located in each of the 16 cells halfway up the wall and in contact with the right-hand tunnel of each set of four tunnels. So it's not all just in the middle, right? Like the food's not just in the middle, the hoppers aren't in the middle, they're separated out into these tunnels and apartments configuration, even though we're still describing a box that's what do we say, it's about 2 meters wide. Two and a half meters wide by 1.5 meters tall,
but it's sort of limiting like avenues for competition for the food because there are these sort of individual points where they can get access to it.
Yeah, but there's also food in the middle as well, which is also important. Mice climbing across the outer surface of the tunnel gained access to the food hopper. 25 mice could simultaneously feed on a hopper. By further climbing up the outside surface of the tunnels, mice had access by to a 10 by 45 centimeter platform above which four water bottles were suspended. Two mice could drink simultaneously at each bottle. An abundant supply of paper strips for nesting materials was always available on the floor a few inches out from the bases of the tunnel. Considering the time required to eat and drink, access to food would not have been a limiting variable until a population of 9,500 was reached, or 6,144 for water. Considering that there were 256 nest retreat sites in the 16 cells, one would not expect shelter to be a limiting factor until the population exceeded 3,840. Due to the tendency of many animals to choose to crowd together in numbers of excess of 15 per nest site, at the peak population size of 2,200 mice, 20% of all nest sites were usually unoccupied. Thus, there was always an opportunity for females to select an unoccupied space for rearing young, if so they choose. So we're limiting mortality. We're limiting their ability to leave the thing. We're making sure that there is not just available resources, but abundant, overly abundant resources. There's too much food, there's too much water for them to possibly go through. Number three, disease control. The Balb C. albino house mice, Mus musculus, used as colonizers in this study, were obtained from the National Institute of Health breeding colony, where extreme precautions are followed to preclude establishment of epidemic-type diseases such as Salmonella. Bacterial culture, taken at the highest density of population, indicated that such organisms were not a factor in our study. About every 4 to 8 weeks, the ground corn cob in all nests in the floor were removed, along with accumulated feces. Point four, predation. No predators were present.
Smart. That was a really good move on his part.
So they had some mortality in the history of the population, but not until they became quite old did the mortality from aging contribute significantly to the removal of members from the population. On the basis of analysis, menopause in females comes at about 560 days of age. They don't know how long the life expectancy is at weaning, but suspect it's well past menopause. Large numbers of mice live to 800 days of age, which is about 80 years for an equivalent human. All right. Subheading, explosive initial population growth, the resource exploitation phase B. Four pairs of 48-day-old Balb C strain house mice were introduced into the 16-cell universe on July 9, 1968, after each mouse had been isolated for 21 days following weaning. There followed a period of 104 days, phase A, before the first litters were born. These 104 days were marked by considerable social turmoil among these eight mice until they had adjusted to each other and to their expanded surroundings. Following this adjustment and the birth of the first litters, the population exhibited an exponential increase with a doubling time of about 55 days. This progression of numbers was approximately 20, 40, 80, 160, 320, and 620 mice after nearly five doublings. I call this period of most rapid growth phase B. At 620 weaned mice, the rate of population growth abruptly decreased to a doubling time of approximately 145 days. Periodically through phase B, young born into the universe reached sexual maturity and bore young, thus contributing to the compound interest rate of population growth. So we're seeing them double and double and double, as you would expect, with abundant resources, abundant room to live, to grow, nothing reducing their numbers. So interestingly, if you imagine we've got this box and we've got the panels arranged around the walls where they're like they've got the ladders up, etc.
Mm-hmm.
They graphed where they ended up, and the mice, the distribution of place of birth during phase B, and they found that the total young born in each of the 64 nests, they put it on a table. It can be seen that births tended to be concentrated in some sets of nest boxes while others had few or none. So this uneven distribution of birth reflects clustering of reproducing females into brood groups, you know, as you'd expect, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. These totals, though, reflect two properties of a closed social system. Number one, bilateral symmetry. The northeast brood group produced only 13 young in 252 days, whereas the opposite southwest brood group produced over eight times as many, 111. So he's claiming that this, and you see this pattern through the distribution of brood groups, where there is lots and lots on one side.
Yeah,
there are very few on the other side, even though they're the furthest points away from each other.
In what way does that constitute bilateral symmetry?
Well, if you take that and you rotate that 90 degrees and divide it by half,
right,
you've got a concentration around where you've divided it, and effectively, you know, bilateral symmetry being you can chop it in half, you know, like a person, and you've got an arm and a leg on an arm on each side and a leg on each side. Similarly, you know, you can slice this in half from, what would that be?
What,
from
through the middle of each of the two groups, which are asymmetrical because one is much more abundant than the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they reduce both in a clockwise and counterclockwise. So if you take the brood group that has lots,
yeah,
and you go either clockwise or counterclockwise, they reduce in each direction.
So if you drew a line, it's a square. If you drew a line through the northeast corner to the southwest, yes, corner, they are all concentrated towards the base of where you've done your dividing line, and yes, then they diminish equally around the edge towards the other side.
And they're symmetrical as well.
Okay, that is genuinely quite interesting.
Thanks. Yes. So, and it says that this indicates attempt by the members of the population to superimpose a more effective bilateral symmetry of organization upon an environment that tends towards radial symmetry. You know, I don't know. Yeah. He seems confident about this. I think he's got a theory in mind here. I just think it's cool. then the hierarchy of, number two, the hierarchy of groups. Productivity of a group may be taken as an index of its social status. They took the 14 brood groups and assigned a rank of them, number one, most productive, and number 14 to the least productive. So most productive produced 111 young, and mm-hmm, the least being 13 young. And if you plot that number of young, the amount of pups produced versus their rank, you get a straight line, which is wild. They are basically ranked with equal distance of like productivity between them.
Huh.
So they talk about this mapping back to a concept called social velocity. So the most dominant male is the most active one, and as social dominance declines, so does the degree of activity. So the most dominant male has the most freedom to participate in society and be active and that kind of thing, and down to the least, where they can basically achieve nothing, and you can use the amount of young that they produce as a proxy of this,
mm-hmm,
which they will explore later. So the degree of dominance of the other territorial males tend to be reflected by the productivity of females being associated with them. So at the end of this phase B, all the most desirable physical space was filled with organized social groups. So these 14 social groups totaled 150 adults. So they've had, you know, like 2,000 pups, but this is over a long period of time, right? So peak population of about 150 adults.
Mm-hmm.
On average, each group contained 10 individuals, including a territorial male, associated males and females, and their juvenile and sub-adult progeny. At the end of phase B, there were 150 adults and then 470 of these immature mice that had experienced good maternal care and early socialization. There were over three times as many younger animals as the socially established older ones, and this number is far greater than would have existed had the normal ecological mortality factors functioned. So basically, they're in a place that they can't die except for being old,
mm-hmm,
and they've got a steady society at this stage. 150 adults, but lots and lots of young. Which brings us to subheading number three, inhibited secondary population growth, the stagnation phase C. Beginning at day 315 after colonization and continuing for 245 more days, population grew at much slower rate, doubling only every 145 days rather than each 55 days. In the normal course of events in a natural ecological setting, somewhat more young survive to maturity than are necessary to replace their dying or senescent established associates. The excess that find no social niches emigrate. However, in my experimental universe, there was no opportunity for emigration, as the unusually large number of young gained adulthood, they had to remain, and so they contested for roles in the filled social system. Males who failed withdrew physically and psychologically. They became very inactive and aggregated in large pools near the center floor of the universe.
Oh, no. You invented Reddit.
It's the Reddit pile. It's literally a big pile of fail sons.
Oh no.
Yeah. From this point on, they no longer initiated interaction with their established associates, nor did their behavior elicit attack by territorial males. So they're getting ignored by the jocks. They're not even getting bullied anymore.
Yeah, they don't even bother. They're like, oh, fucking don't even look at them. Don't give them time of day.
Even so, they became characterized by many wounds and much scar tissue as a result of attacks by other withdrawn males.
Oh.
Return of two or more males who had gone to eat and drink marked an abrupt shift in the level of ambient stimuli for the quiescent associates. So they're just fucking chilling out.
Yeah.
And two of the most annoying dudes you've ever met come back from lunch. And it's bite time.
Yeah. Because that's literally the only thing that's happened all day.
That's right. They're just staring at the wall and fucking Greg comes back.
Yeah. Let's get him.
Let's get him.
Sick of shit.
And so they just, and because they've got nowhere to run to because they don't belong in society anymore.
Can't leave society.
They can't leave society. They've only got the pile on the floor. They haven't got anywhere to run. So they just fight each other.
Mm-hmm.
A mouse so attacked would at later time become an attacker. Female counterparts of these withdrawn males tended to withdraw at higher level boxes that were less preferred by females with litters. So they're not just incels, they're also sex nerds, I would assume.
Yeah.
So as the result of extreme demands made on territorial males to reject maturing associates, their ability to continue territorial defense declined. Gradually, the frequency of this involvement in territorial defense declined, as did the area defended. This left nursing females more exposed to invasion of their nest sites. Normally, nursing females in the presence of territorial males exhibit little aggression. However, in response to an invasion of nest sites and bases of ramps leading to them, the nursing females did become aggressive, essentially taking over the role of the territorial males. This aggression generalized to their own young, who were attacked, wounded, and forced to leave home several days before normal weaning. During phase C, the incidence of conception declined, and the resorption of fetuses increased. So they're so depressed and, like, lacking good male models that they're just, like, reabsorbing the fetuses in the womb. They're like, you know what?
Fuck it. I don't want it.
I'm just going to zip this one away.
Is that a biological mechanism they have available to them? Like a...
So says.
It's fucking wild.
Maternal behavior often became disrupted. Young were often wounded in the delivery process. Females transported their young to several sites, during which process some were abandoned. Many litters of young age on one survey disappeared before the next survey. Such abandoning of young following survey disturbance is a particularly sensitive index of dissolution of maternal behavior. The combined effect of these several factors affecting reduced conception, increased fetal mortality, and increased pre-weaning mortality largely accounts for the abrupt decline in the rate of population growth characterizing phase C. For all practical purposes, there had been a death of societal organization by the end of phase C. Subheading 4, decline of population size, the death phase D. Population increase abruptly ceased on day 560 after colonization. A few mice born up until day 600 survived past weaning. Between these times, deaths just slightly exceeded births. Beyond the time of the last surviving birth on day 600, the incidence of pregnancies declined very rapidly, with no young surviving. Last conception was about day 920.
Oh.
So society has effectively fallen apart so much that through apparently no other factor, they have children of men themselves.
Yeah.
They have children of mice.
Fuck. I don't really... Is it psychological?
Well, it's the second death, Ben.
Yeah, of course, the second death.
Because they took away they took away the first death. Now, this is the death of the spirit.
Yeah.
Within these mice.
It's like what happened at the end of Star Wars Episode 3.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I'll take your word for it.
You've seen it. Don't act like you haven't seen
it. I have, but I don't remember it. I remember
Padme just
the lava.
Dies just because she gives up.
Okay.
She's just like, nah, too depressed. I'm out of here.
All right.
Yeah.
With the increase of rate of mortality accompanying senescence in the population, has continued decline in numbers. By March 1st, 1972, the average age of survivors was 776 days, over 200 days beyond menopause. So they're just getting old now, right?
Getting old, not getting having old. Kids.
No kids.
Yeah.
On June 22nd, 1972, there were only 122, 22 male, 100 female survivors. Projection of the prior few months of exponential decline in numbers indicate that the last surviving male would be dead on May 23rd, 1973, 1,780 days after colonization. The population will be reproductively definitely dead at that time, although such death was predicted by 700 days after colonization. This demise of population contradicts prior knowledge, which indicates that when a population declines to a few remnant groups, some individuals will reinitiate its growth.
Yeah, I was going to say, even like statistically speaking, wouldn't you think there would be a few like outliers that just brought new babies into the colony?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know because this is so deliberately a bizarre scenario that they've constructed.
Yeah.
But what he says is that effectively they've just broken society so badly that the chain of like of behavior of you know teaching and experience has just disappeared.
Yeah.
Turning back to the end of phase C, the seeds of eventual destruction may already be seen to have been sown. By midway in phase C, essentially all young were prematurely rejected by their mothers. They started independent life without having developed adequate effective bonds. Then, as they moved out into an already dense population, many attempts to engage in social interaction were mechanically disrupted by passage of other mice. Lastly, I've shown in Calhoun, 1963, that in proportion to the extent that the group size exceeds the optimum, maximizing gratification from such interactions necessitates a decrease in the intensity and duration of such behaviors. This fragments otherwise more complex behaviors. As a result of these three processes, number one, failure to develop early social bonding, number two, mechanical interference with developing social behaviors, and number three, fragmentation of behaviors, maturation of the more complex social behaviors, such as those involved in courtship, maternity and aggression failed. For females, a clear example may be taken from a two-cell universe studied in parallel with the 16-cell one, detailed here. Members of this population were killed 300 days after the inflection point of the shift from phase C to phase D. Among these, 148 females born within the last 50 days were before the end of phase C. At autopsy at a median age of 334 days, only 18% had ever conceived and only 2% were pregnant. By this age, most females in a normal population would have had five or more litters, most of them successfully reared. Male counterparts to these non-reproducing females we soon dubbed the beautiful ones. They never engaged in sexual approaches towards females, and they never engaged in fighting. And so they had no wound or scar tissue. Just gliding through life, completely pure and free.
Yeah, I assume exactly the sort of life that Fabio lived.
Yeah. Thus, their pelage remained in excellent condition, just like Fabio. Their behavioral repertoire became largely confined to eating, drinking, sleeping, and grooming, none of which carried any social implications beyond that represented by contiguity of bodies. Most of the last half of the population born in the 16-cell universe were fully or largely like these non-reproducing females and these beautiful ones, the males. As their formerly more competent predecessors gradually became senescent, their already disrupted capacity for reproduction terminated. At this time, only the beautiful one category of males and their counterpart females remained at an age normally compatible with reproduction, but they had long since failed to develop this capacity. Subheading, conclusion. The results obtained in this study should be obtained when customary causes of mortality become markedly reduced in any species of mammal whose members form social groups. I wonder what he's thinking of here. Reduction of bodily death, i.e. the second death, culminates in a survival of an excessive number of individuals that have developed the potentiality for occupying the social roles characteristic of the species. Within a few generations, all such roles in all physical space available to the species are filled. At this time, the continuing high survival of many individuals to sexual and behavioral maturity culminates in the presence of many young adults capable of involvement in appropriate species-specific activities. Normal societal organization, i.e. the establishment, breaks down. It dies. Youngborns during such social dissolution are rejected by their mothers and other adult associates. The early failure of social bonding becomes compounded by interruption of action cycles due to the mechanical interference resulting from the high contact rate among individuals living in high-density population. They are no longer capable of executing the most complex behaviors compatible with species survival. The species in such settings die. For an animal so complex as man, there is no logical reason why a comparable sequence of events should not also lead to species extinction. For opportunities for role fulfillment fall far short of the demand by those capable of filling roles and having expectations to do so, only violence and disruption of social organization can follow. Individuals born under these circumstances will be so out of touch with reality as to be incapable even of alienation. Jesus Christ.
What does that even mean?
That they... That a well-functioning society, or as defined by this, you know, self-pruning process that he's saying that he's taken away, mm-hmm. has the ability to alienate people that are fucked.
Yeah.
Right? By their standards. But in the circumstances that he's describing, you know, they are so potentially out of touch with reality that alienation is impossible. They cannot understand being alienated. And, you know, I'm considering like the continued emergence of things like QAnon and just bizarre beliefs, you know, climate denialism, that you can describe in absolute terms and in objective terms, but effectively, you know, society begins to run out of ways of alienating these people because they are simply too out of touch with reality.
Yeah, sure.
Their most complex behaviors become fragmented. Acquisition, creation, and utilization of ideas appropriate for life in a post-industrial, cultural, conceptual, technological society will have been blocked. Just as biological generativity in the mouse involves this species' most complex behaviors, so does ideational generativity for man. Loss of these respective complex behaviors means death of the species. Mortality, bodily death equals the second death. Drastic reduction of mortality equals death of the second death equals death squared equals death squared, but notated differently. Death squared leads to dissolution of social organization equals death of the establishment. Death of the establishment leads to spiritual death equals loss of capability to engage in behaviors essential to the species society equals the first death. Therefore, death squared equals the first death. Happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. Wisdom is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. All her paths lead to peace.
Just to simplify his final equation, his ultimate finding is that death equals death.
Yeah.
Death squared
equals the first death. So the second death being mortality and bodily death.
Yeah, which then leads to...
If you get rid of mortality,
yeah.
He considers that death squared, which is the first death. So if you get rid of mortality as an influence in your population, you are effectively, or he's effectively equating that with the death of the spirit.
Yeah.
The death of the individual to carry on, to keep the species going, etc.
Which leads us back to the first death.
The first death, yes.
You get rid of the first death, that gives us the second death, which is the first death.
Which is the first death, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Theo, it's very interesting that it seems like a crazy coincidence that you've gone with this one, given, and this keeps happening.
This keeps happening.
Choosing things that are related. Now, have you ever thought about how many lab mice there are in the world right now?
No, but I am thinking about it. Yeah, got it.
The year is 1830. A potter from Blaubeuren by the name of Karl Friedrich Rixinger is digging for clay in a cave about a kilometre and a half east of the town of Schellklingen.
Digging for clay.
He's digging for clay.
Come to my yard, buddy.
Yeah, surely there's clay.
Take as much as you need.
There's clay all over the place. Go down to the river, pal. I'm following Minecraft rules for where you find clay. He finds the bones of a prehistoric cave bear, which he sells to district forest officer of the city of Ulm, the Count Friedrich von Mandelsloh.
Fuck, it must have been great to be alive in the 1830s, except for all the racists.
Isn't that the lyric from the song Taylor Swift just put out?
Yeah.
1830? Doesn't she say the 1830s?
Yeah.
Holy fuck.
I know, that's why I said it.
Edit out the part that makes it seem like I didn't get the joke. Mark? If you leave that in, I'm going to fucking kill you. I mean, it would have been an amazing time. Like, that you are you're a potter from Blaubeuren.
It's a shame that she, like, was so fucking clumsy about it. She should have sung about this guy.
About the Karl Friedrich Rixinger.
I thought I was just going to sell some clay today.
Yeah, but instead, I sold prehistoric cave bear bones to the Count Friedrich von Mandelsloh.
You can't do that anymore. No. The spawns have all dried up.
There's no pathway to doing that. You're not going to incidentally come across some cave bear bones, and you're not going to be able to sell them to Friedrich Graf von Mantelsloh.
No.
That's just not on the fucking cards. He sold them to Friedrich Graf von Mantelsloh because he was an amateur paleontologist and a geologist. Although Rixinger did not reveal where he found the bones, like which cave he found them in, to Friedrich at that time.
You don't want to give up your bone source.
Yeah, you don't want Friedrich von Mandelsloh to camp your spawn of cave bear bones. 1844, Georg Reichenbach, a cotton manufacturer at the Benedictine Monastery of Erspring, he goes to that same cave and he mines it for bat guano to be used as fertilizer.
What a
There's so many different ways of doing stuff back then.
God damn it. This is why, like, Dwarf Fortress is so compelling.
Yeah.
Like, no one's going to the ancient bear bones caves and mining for guano anymore.
When is the last time you found a good source for a resource? Like, in the world around you, you were like, ooh, I could use this to construct something.
Yeah. The fog of war is all lifted.
Yeah.
We have
can see
the
whole
map
now.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you learn that kind of as a teenager, that Age of Empires actually stops being fun if you use all the cheats and you turn off all the fog of war and you've got infinite resources. What's the point?
What's the point?
The gameplay actually comes from the challenge.
Yeah.
That's what makes life fun. In the years 1870 and 1871, the cave got some more attention. The head of the Royal Natural History Museum in Stuttgart, Oscar Fraß, who had been excavating caves in the area searching for prehistoric animal bones, he excavates this same cave in conjunction with Pastor Josef Hartmann of Wittingen. So he's enrolled a local clergyman to help him with this.
That's another dope thing that, like, we used to do. I mean, look, obviously, the church had some problems, but they also used to do cool shit because there were members of society that just sat around largely unoccupied.
Yeah, and they could read.
Yeah,
which was huge.
Yeah, and they knew how to read. You know, like so. Our understanding of the statistics of why things happen due to other things happening came from a guy named Bayes, who was a clergyman of some kind, priest, I think. I don't know. I don't fucking know. But they're just like, all right, well, let's just sit around and work out why shit happens.
Yeah.
Have a think about it.
Why not? What else are you going to do?
Yeah.
You just go to the one guy in your town that knows how to read books and you ask him every question you have. Like, I saw a horrible beast in the woods. It looks kind of like this.
Yeah. That's Bigfoot, dude. But he's one of God's creatures.
That's right. He's fucked up. So in this excavation, they find an abundance of skeletal remains from prehistoric cave bears, reindeer, mammoth, and wild horses, as well as tools belonging to the, say, Aurignacian culture of the Upper Paleolithic. So a lot of stuff in that cave.
Yeah. Pretty
cool.
It's kind of a everything happening at once in this cave kind of deal. Well, not at once, over like millions of years, I guess.
Yeah, like geological time spans, yeah.
Yeah.
In 1872, the Anthropological Association, together with Rudolf Virchow, the founder of the Berlin Society for Anthropology, Ethnology, and Prehistory, they conduct a tour of the cave as part of a conference. Enough material is found in the cave to fill a railway car.
Dope.
That's not happening anymore.
No.
You know? The contents of which are sent to the Stuttgart Museum of Natural History. During this time, the cave is locked off from the general public. They actually build a gate in front of it.
Yep.
Probably smart. As part of the tour that is conducted, every participant in the tour is allowed to select one object and take it home as a souvenir.
Yes.
They're also not letting you do that.
They can't, yeah.
They're not letting you pick up some like 50,000-year-old cave bear bones. But oh, go on. Have one for yourself. Take that home.
You don't get to take relics home anymore. My reliquary is completely empty.
Oh, I'd kill to put something in my reliquary.
There's so many slots there.
1906, Tubingen prehistorian Robert Rudolf Schmidt, who has been studying the finds from the 1870s exploration, re-examines the cave but finds no new significant archaeological layers. So,
all right, we're done.
Yeah, everyone kind of ignores it for a while until 1936, the cave, which is known as Hohle Fels, which is German for hollow rock, is named a protected natural monument.
I'd call it Bone Cave.
Yeah, the Cave of Cool Bones.
Cave of
the Cave of Bones that are dope. So there are more excavations that come afterwards and they start finding some more stuff. So in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of excavation done by the archaeologist Gustav Rieck. Now, Gustav Rieck.
In the 50s and 60s, hey?
Yeah. Now, Gustav Rieck was actually quite active in the 30s and 40s as well.
Okay.
As a member of, I can't remember how to pronounce it, but it was essentially the SS division of scare quote historians and archaeologists who were like proving the world's Aryan history. Yeah. So like they'd go to cave sites and be like, wow, these guys were blonde.
Uh-huh.
Oh boy, were they blonde. So yeah, not a great guy.
It's so cool how anything starts in the 50s and 60s in Germany and you go, hey, what happened before that?
Yeah, what were you doing not that long ago? Yeah.
Not that long ago.
Are you doing something in 1955? What were you doing exactly 10 years ago?
We have been enjoying Fanta for 15 years.
You know what? I don't even miss Coca-Cola. Later, another archaeologist named Joachim Hahn, I think it's pronounced, sorry, unearthed a large amount of findings relating to the Gravettian and Magdalenian prehistoric cultures.
Okay.
Over the years, the site yields an enormous number of prehistoric finds, including, most notably, and I think I have actually mentioned this work of art in the one of the first theophiles we did in the Makapansgat Pebble one, but the Venus of Hohle Fels, which is a Venus sculpture, a sort of exaggerated statue of a woman as a sort of fertility symbol. Mm-hmm. This is 40,000 years old. And is considered the oldest undisputed example of a depiction of a human being. So no sort of wiggle room.
Imagine if you got to take that one home from the tour.
Oh, you would have been fucking so smug. Oh, you guys didn't get the Venus of Hohle Fels?
Yeah, I kind of came away with the Venus of Hohle Fels. I don't know.
We really need to study this because it's unbelievably important in anthropology. Well, it's kind of my souvenir, so. Yeah. Just got to keep it in my den.
I think I might let my kids just sort of like
throw it to each other in perfect spirals. 2005, a team of archaeologists from the University of Tübingen announced the culmination of 5 years of excavation after finding the 14th fragment of a Gravettian period artifact that is dated to approximately 28,000 years ago. When reconstructed, the artifact, which is composed of polished siltstone, is 19.2 centimeters long, 3.6 centimeters wide, 2.8 centimeters thick, and weighs about 287 grams. Uh-huh. So sort of hold those dimensions in your hands. What's that? 19.2 centimeters, that's like 6 inches, I think?
Yep.
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, 7 inches.
Yeah. The piece of stone has strike marks that indicate that it was likely used as a napping stone. So do you know what? You'd use a napping stone to shape a sharpened bit of flint. So you'd sort of, that's right. You'd chip off like the edges until you got exposed sharp edges, and you'd use that to sort of give yourself a spearhead or an arrowhead or a knife or something. The other feature that it has, other than being a long, very, very, very polished bit of stone, is that towards one end, it has a number of etchings that together form a single ring that sort of, at a bit of an off-kilter angle, circumscribes the tip.
Okay. You say 7 inches.
Yeah. So it's a penis. Yeah. It's unambiguously, no expert in the world disagrees. It is a polished siltstone penis about the size of the average penis,
which is 7 inches.
Which is, that's right, give or take. Now, no one has made a definitive ruling about this because they can't, but there does seem to be a prevailing attitude that despite the fact that this had use as a tool, was maybe also of religious significance, the fact that it is very close to life size indicates that it was maybe used for sexual gratification.
Yeah.
Because, like... penises were quite common in sort of, like, we have a lot of example of penises throughout art, prehistoric and otherwise.
Yeah.
But often when people had them as like good luck charms or whatever, they were just very small because it's easier to make something small. But yeah, the fact that this is of a usable size.
And polished as if it had been buffed by.
Very polished, like unbelievably polished.
Yeah, there was something like this in like that they unearthed from an ancient cave in Cornwall from the Pengelly tribe, but it was 4.5 inches long.
It can't have been useful because that's not close to life size. Now, if this is correct, that this is an
ancient dildo,
Yeah. It is the oldest dildo that we have ever found.
Yeah,
and you will sort of note that, like, the dildo hasn't come that far, technologically speaking, you know? Like, there was a bit of stagnation after the advent of this dildo.
Yeah, they're sort of, like, kind of resting on their laurels there for the next 30,000 years.
That's right. There were some improvements, somewhere between roughly 13,000 and 9,000 years ago, start emerging examples of the first double-ended dildos.
Oh.
Yeah, they've been around for a really fucking long time.
How long did it take them to become flared?
I did actually read something about this. Sorry, I didn't make it into the notes, but they have like ancient Roman butt plugs that have flared bases on them, which is wild, right?
Yeah, and this is, you know... So sad that the Roman Empire collapsed.
Yeah, they were achieving such heights.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, the human body has been like this for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Like a really long time. And it is the things that feel good on the human body now have felt good that entire time. So, obviously, you know, we have the ability to make objects. We have the ability to see things that we would like in the world to figure out, hey, maybe putting something in there would feel kind of good, and just doing it. So It's not like a shocking surprise, right?
Putting things in your butt 30,000 years ago probably still make you cum.
Yes. Oh, maybe even more so because you never, you're not overstimulated.
Yeah, and they've got the sort of pure pre-COVID
DNA. They've got fog. Yeah, that's right.
Pre-COVID sort of went from 2020 all the way back to...
This isn't the pre-COVID era. I bet a lot of think pieces use that. The next major breakthrough, however, wasn't for fucking ages. So the obvious next step, which is...
Yeah, everyone was too busy fucking their pussies and buttholes with dildos.
It turns out that was actually enough.
Yeah.
For most people for a very long time.
Hey, do you need more than this? No.
I'm fine.
I'm good.
Yep, I'm having a great time.
Yeah, I might have a little nap.
I'm sleepy now. The next major breakthrough, which is, of course, the electromechanical vibrator, happened not until the 19th century, which, I mean, I guess makes sense given the electromechanical.
It's so funny to imagine like an early 1800s vibrator.
Yeah.
Steam-powered.
Pistons.
Yeah.
You've got like a train of horses. Like... it was first marketed as a device for treating medical ailments by applying it topically to that area. Now, everyone loves to chime in with that fun fact about vibrators being things that doctors used on women's bodies to cure them of hysteria.
Yes.
It's not true. That's made up. That's not a real thing.
Okay. Scratching that one out.
Instead were like literally applying them topically to the area where you were having trouble. So if you had a headache, you would press the vibrator against your head. You had a tummy ache, you'd press the vibrator against your tummy. Like the same sort of, I mean, it probably feels nice.
Feels nice.
Yeah. The headache thing I can maybe see. The invention of it is generally attributed to one of two men. There was an English doctor named Joseph Mortimer Granville.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a French doctor named Romain Vigouroux. I just have a gut feeling about which of those two men it was.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I couldn't explain it, but my women's intuition is telling me that Romain Vigouroux invented the vibrator.
Uh-huh.
Impossible to say, though. Now, you'll note that even with these incredible leaps, the three leaps in the technology that we had in 30,000 years.
And that brings us all the way to today.
Yeah, that's right. They're still sort of painfully shackled to like a physical mechanism. You know, there's something sort of clunky about them. But we actually managed to overcome that in the 1970s, which I'm sure you would have heard about this. You'd obviously remember it. I'm just reading it to you for fun. You remember how you said that yours was in January of 1973?
Yes.
Well, by crazy coincidence, mine's in September of 1974, which is close-ish.
It's sort of...
It's kind of close.
Right on the button.
I mean, when we're talking in scales of 30,000 years, the fact that we both arrived at a thing that took place within like a year and a half of each other, or 2 years of each other. Pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Rolling Stone article from September 26, 1974. Here we go. It sits there like an old Hoover vacuum cleaner. Only it doesn't inhale dust. It exhales vibrations. And the hose isn't coming out of a squat globe, but out of the top of a cube about 14 inches on a side, painted fire engine red.
Oh,
this man's got the contraption.
He's got the contraption.
He's got the gizmo.
Man, I love a good cube.
Yeah, me too. It's so satisfying. Even the word is funny.
Mm-hmm. The word cube feels like a cube.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like a cube. That's very true.
Yeah. Can I regale you? Can we do a quick Theosies?
I would love to, very much.
I had a dream that there was a sci-fi movie made on an ultra-low budget called Cubed, C-U-B-D. It was about an invasion of invisible, extremely psychically powerful aliens I was the protagonist for a while, and I discovered they couldn't go through water because I was in a big public toilet where several of them swept in and killed everybody. But I was hiding by hanging from the outside wall of a cubicle over the urinal, and they couldn't cross the urinal to get to me. It took some convincing of other survivors that my story was true. The title was Cubed because the aliens left big cubes of sand on beaches everywhere. I was also in my grandma's old house holding the DVD of this movie.
Oh. I mean, it shares a common ancestor with Signs, I think.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, that's my dream Cubed. About the movie Cubed.
Can I give you a quick Ben OCs?
Ben oh, sees. Please.
I don't know why the O would still be there. I had a dream last night that Maddie and I got a rescue horseshoe crab, like as another pet, except it was like 3 feet tall. It was fucking massive. And in the dream, Louis and the horseshoe crab were best friends. Like, oh, they would goodness. Just play around the house.
I can imagine it.
And like the one detail that really sticks out to me is that they would like curl up to sleep together at night. But one of Louis's moves that he does is that he wants to sleep next to you for your body warmth. But sometimes he does it a little too vigorously and he'll actually flop all 40 kilos of his body weight onto you.
Yeah.
And we had to be like, no, you can't do that because the horseshoe crab is quite fragile and his crustacean-y armor will break. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Fun to imagine. I don't know why I was thinking about horseshoe crabs. Hal Vuxbress, that's this man's name. His first name is Hal. It's H-O-W. And that is, Hal Vuxbress talks about it as if it were a monolith from 2001. Hal, that's his whole first name, has luxuriant black hair, immense mutton chop sideburns, and a gentle inward expression as if he's keeping quiet about a surprise party. Yeah. I don't know about you, but I'm picturing him as Joaquin Phoenix in Inherent Vice.
Yeah. Except he invented the cube that sucks you off.
Yeah, he invented the cube that, in a way, blows you off.
Blows you off, yeah.
His monolith is the, quote, Audatac Sonic Stimulator. It's a sort of limited access loudspeaker for every part of your body except the ears. Quote, the Beatles on your back, Bartok on your belly, croons an Audatac leaflet, Beethoven between your legs.
Yeah.
Yep.
What about Dillinger Escape Plan on your doodle?
Yeah. It's the first in a series of, quote, tactile communication devices Hal thinks are going to revolutionize our society as much as television has. At the moment, the papa of the revolutionary device is sitting tight. So this is written in the early 70s. I just want to... early 70s, so some of the language might seem a little stupid. Not one sonic stimulator has been sold for fear of interference on his patent applications. But on the morning after Richard Nixon's resignation, he kindly consented to give Rolling Stone's unbiased test panel a demonstration of the device, plus unlimited glasses of apple juice. Doesn't this give such a beautiful sense of time and place?
Uh-huh.
You know, the historic day after Richard Nixon's resignation. And the specific... He gave us apple juice while we were at his house.
Oh, so wonderful.
The sonic stimulator idea is simple. The ear is a specialized organ for transmitting sound signals to the brain. But since sound is merely physical vibration, any pressure-sensitive organ can, quote, hear.
Yeah.
Which is just kind of like abusing like the specific meaning of the word hear. Like, you're also using it to mean feel in this context.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the ear does an important sort of extra thing of turning it into...
It turns feeling into hearing.
Into hearing.
Yeah, that's what those tiny little hairs are for.
Whereas this turns feeling into feeling.
Yes, there. It doesn't have the crucial middle step that the ear provides. The ear's blessing, we call it.
Yeah. Imagine if your perineum could hear, though.
If this perineum could hear.
Yeah, what stories would it?
Would it have heard?
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine if it could hear and talk.
Now, there's a sitcom.
One perineum. That's the name of the sitcom. It's the only character. The palm of the hand, for instance, very good, says Howe. Good hi-fi reception because of its abundance of nerve endings. Or the groin,
yeah.
Also good for the same reason and because of the various internal organs nearby, each with its own complement of senses. The elbows and knees are good listeners too because they readily transfer sound vibrations to the skeleton, thus sending messages from all over the body.
So he puts groin right in the middle.
Yeah,
not
even though
like
it's kind
extremis.
Of... It's not the main event.
No.
Either put it last or first, I reckon. Probably last.
Probably
for sizzle.
Last. Work yeah. up, yeah.
You don't want people to get disappointed with the rest of the list. Oh, I guess you could blast my knees as well, but
yeah.
kind sort of thinking about
it's sort of like the opposite of when are they gonna get to the firework factory. They've been yeah. to the firework factory.
And now we're just sort of cruising around downtown. the experience is a little like being at a live concert on about 12 square inches of your body.
Okay.
Maybe yep. on your body.
Yeah. Taking my nuts to deer hoof.
Are you
getting them all shook up?
Again?
Yeah.
The music is faintly audible to the ears, but the air in the probe is pummeling your flesh like a concert hall speaker.
Hmm. Okay.
That does sound nice.
Yeah.
Honestly, I love the sound of just being sort of blasted by very loud sound but not being deafened by it, I think would be very nice.
Hmm.
How can envision... I keep going to fuck up these sentences because how, his name, is also the word how.
Yeah.
So you've got to start it as a question. How can envision a setup that would cover the entire body with sound vibrations but would make so little audible noise that the landlady would never know the Fillmore was going on upstairs?
Yeah, I mean, so do headphones.
A better system would involve having the hose filled with liquid instead of air.
Yeah, I mean, you could just pump it through like a bath or something, right?
Yeah. Which would still... Oh, you wouldn't hear it nearly as good from outside of the water, would you?
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah, says Howe. I've played with it in the bathtub. But you end up with such a mess.
Yeah, who hasn't?
It's a long and winding road that has led this 29-year-old from being an aeronautics major at Brooklyn Tech to an audio inventor in a tiny and incredibly compact San Francisco apartment stuffed with electronics paraphernalia, even in the kitchen. Fortunately, Howe Voxpress is equipped to understand it. He's into Alan Watts, dynamical analogies, basic psychophysical processes, the concept of unity.
I feel like he's... incapable of handling anything.
Understanding things on the level where essential difference disappears between, say, sound and electricity. I feel like if you're working, but I don't know. You should probably maybe have a more concrete understanding. But hey, he's the guy that invented the cube.
Yeah. He kind of came up with the cube that kind of makes your nuts vibrate.
Yeah. And that's changed society more than TV. So that was good work on his part. As he recounts his life story, he regularly pauses to sum it up in terms of larger processes, such as, quote, so my interest in audio went through these stages, reproduction, recording, synthesis, multimedia.
They're looking at the door, kind of checking their watch, like, do we get to fuck ourselves with the hose again? Or
yeah, when are you going to blast us with the hose?
Got to keep listening to this.
During a trip to London in 1966, he was inspired to revive his childhood dream of being an inventor when he saw a museum exhibit of the prototypes of famous inventions. Back in New York, he scurried around in audio technology, something he'd returned to after Cooper Union. Then he fell into a situation that changed his life. It was 1969 on the Lower East Side, and as he says, quote, hair was in the streets, not on the stage.
Hair was in the streets, not on the stage.
Yep. So before Hair the musical, people... Is he saying that people were embodying the lifestyle depicted in Hair, but in real life, or just that people were generally hairier?
Hairier.
That's where the 60s. Hair was. Yeah. One of the unique institutions cast up by the wild ferment of those days was a sort of psychedelic playground called Cerebrum. Now, I think you'd really enjoy Cerebrum, Theo. Let me describe it to you. 56 customers at a time would spend a couple of hours wearing translucent white robes, being fed strawberries soaked in wine, and playing with touchy-feely toys like giant balloons, lying under collapsed tents of parachute material and stroking each other with hand lotion.
It's pure luxury.
The addition of a low-key light show and music made it what was dubbed a sensorium.
Sure. Okay.
Can you imagine? Fuck. You put on your translucent robe. You get real comfy. You're being hand-fed strawberries soaked in wine. You're rubbing other people. You're feeling some lovely balloons.
God. There just isn't enough. Like, man.
You couldn't do that these days.
I was thinking about onsens the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And just the experience of being like publicly bathing because it fucking rocks.
Yeah.
It's dope. You just go and sit in a big hot pool of water. Watch some snow monkeys.
I want that so bad.
It's so good. But instead I'm riding Python.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what society did to us.
That's what they did to us.
Howe was brought in to fix the sound system. He was also a Cerebrum, quote, guide.
I don't want to know what that means.
No, I don't want to know either. Cerebrum eventually folded, a victim of cash flow problems, and, in Howe's opinion, an inability to interest customers in returning. It's kind of odd that you go there once and don't want to come back.
You're absolutely burnt out on pleasure.
All of my pleasure receptors just can't feel shit anymore. Quote, somebody called those the go-go years, he recalls. It was a wild time. People were trying anything. I got into all the senses. I was inventing atomizers. I still have a scent library. And it was at that time that I got the original acid flash of multimedia, the idea of two-way tactile communication over a distance, carrying it to its most outrageous extension, a fuck-by-phone machine.
All right. So this guy's inventing, like, love ants in...
Yes, he is. So this is what got me started on it, and led me to here, is he is the guy sort of officially, not that anyone is really doing this in an official capacity, but he's the guy generally recognized with inventing the concept of teledildonics.
Teledildonics, yeah. It's the word on everyone's lips.
The guy that coined the word teledildonics cited what this guy was talking about. As the reason that he was thinking about teledildonics. So this guy's the father of teledildonics.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is everything I have about that guy, except I have two little bonus facts for you. One, actually, not really a fact. It's just a quote from an article from SF Weekly. I believe San Francisco, not science fiction, hard to say. They got him to sort of give a soundbite to an article about... a very old patent for teledildonics lapsing, and he was talking about how he doesn't like modern sex robots, and I just really like this one paragraph. Here we go. You don't need a robot, Howe Workspress says. These big fucking machines with hydraulics, they're so crude. It's just a suck and fuck kind of thing, which is boring. Eroticism is barely understood.
That's so beautiful. What robots are he describing?
A $7,000 sex robot sold by True Companion LLC.
Okay.
Yeah, doesn't sound good. And the other bonus fact that I have for you is sort of corollary to this, I was looking at sex toys for penises.
Yeah.
Just to see what the history of that is. Do you know that the Fleshlight wasn't patented until 1998?
So as in like a... As an original concept, like a tube of latex that you can fuck.
Yeah. As far as I can tell, there isn't really an equivalent of that style device before the Fleshlight. 1998. Yeah. It's not that long ago.
Because I was probably fucking the gap between the mattresses in 1998. Could have been under $1 billion.
If you'd had one more thought. It's not
doesn't work, by the way.
It's not the same. It's not the first artificial vagina, though. The artificial, yeah, like an artificial vagina you can have sex with. The earliest references we have to one, apparently, as in one that is like a, not just replicating the sensation, but sort of replicating the appearance of. There are some French texts from as early as 1904 referencing realistic vaginas on blow-up dolls.
Oh.
Like 120 years ago, we had the blow-up doll. Isn't that fucking crazy?
Now it's
you don't
a
really
joke.
Hear about those anymore. Like no. Every movie from like the 70s to the 90s had a blow-up doll gag in there.
And now, people were fucking them?
I guess people were fucking them, but it can't have been good.
Can't have been good.
There's no way.
We've come so far as a society.
Yeah, I don't even know if they were really that...
Just to mimic a fraction of the vagina's true power.
Yes, the divine feminine energy.
Penis, perfectly replicatable.
Yeah.
30,000 years ago, Buddha knew about this.
Yeah. Just polish a bit of siltstone.
Yeah.
I wonder what the uptake on the blob doll was like. Kind of been good. There's future Theophiles, mate. We'll look into that. I'll look into that. Don't you look into it.
Okay.
Hey, that was definitely an episode of the Theophiles. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got a live show coming up.
Yeah.
It's on June 15th. It's in beautiful Brisbane, Queensland. I think it's going to be very good. You might be hearing this in early May if you're a paybo. You might be hearing this much closer to the date if you're a freebo, but either way, you should definitely come, even if you have to travel. There's lots of cool stuff to do in Brisbane. It'll be nice. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.